Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I'm your host, Graham Culbertson, and my guest today is Joan Slonczewski, the author of this really wonderful book, A Door into Ocean, and other books, which we'll get to in a second. But before I let Joan introduce themselves, I just want to say some of you learned about this book at the same time as I did, because I was talking to Kim Stanley Robinson about his book, Aurora. And he just mentioned that he was at that time, I think we recorded that interview in January of 2026, maybe, reading Joan's book and highly recommended it. And I got it from the library and I devoured it and immediately interviewed Joan and asked him to come on the show. And here we are. So, Joan, why don't you tell the listeners who you are and I guess a bit about the book when you get there.
Well, so I'm a longtime microbiologist and researcher at Kenyon College. My research is about bacteria, including gut bacteria, that are part of the human gut-brain axis. So bacteria that tell us what to do. And so that's my real-life job. But at the same time, I've written science fiction novels since 1986. Two of my novels, A Door into Ocean and The Highest Frontier, have won the Campbell Award. And A Door into Ocean was about people that who are genetic engineers that live on a planet covered entirely by ocean, and they have microbes in their skin that help them to breathe longer underwater. So that's where the microbes come in. All my books include microbes. But these people are a nonviolent community. They live on floating rafts on the ocean, and they have to repel a space invasion from another planet, a more traditional medieval type planet. And so part of what my book is about nonviolent resistance.
Yes. So, I mean, it's about nonviolent resistance. And I do, there's a lot I want to say about nonviolent resistance, but I should say before we were recording, you said that you were interested in, you know, sort of my thoughts, about the concept of anarchism and the relationship to A Door into Ocean. And I mean, I have to say, so for me, so there have been many, many, many science fiction depictions of societies that would be considered, anarchic, some of them that people, you know, explicitly labeled anarchist. The two most famous or most well established in the anarchist tradition are the famous book The Dispossessed by Ursula Le Guin, and then William Morris refused to consider himself an anarchist, and he kept founding socialist groups that everyone left except for the anarchists, because William Morris was an anarchist, but he, for a variety of reasons, it was very important to him not to claim to be an anarchist. And so I am anachronistic claiming him. So the other book is News from Nowhere by William Morris. Those are the two that I hold up. There's a third techno-futurist one, a series of novels. They're usually called The Culture by this writer, Ian M. Banks. That's another one where Banks's narrator does use the A word, does describe the culture as anarchist or maybe even anarchish. I usually reference those three as the clearest depictions of what anarchism could be in a science fiction context. But of course, there are many more writers influenced by the anarchist tradition who have done this sort of thing. When I read A Door into Ocean, my initial response was that I'm going to start telling people that there are three science fiction novels that clearly demonstrate what an anarchist society would look like. And I want to add A Door into Ocean to News from Nowhere and The Dispossessed. This is, for those of you who haven't read it, and I do recommend reading it, this is a book where all of the ideas of, you know, what I would say is the, it's sometimes called the Christian wing of anarchism. You might call it the cosmic or transcendental wing of anarchism. It has a history that I like to trace through among other things, the transcendentalist philosophers like Emerson and Thoreau, but also through Quakerism and all sorts of places. And your book, the society in your book, strikes me as an expression of the highest ideals of this form of anarchism. It is nonviolent. It is non-hierarchical. I should stop talking in a second and let you talk. But one of the things that happens a lot in these depictions of anarchist societies is when an authoritarian or hierarchical society comes, they tend to ask the classic question, take me to your leader. And for an anarchist society, they can't do that. I mean, this is one of the tensions all throughout A Door into Ocean is the patriarchal violent society keeps trying to find the person who represents, who speaks for, who commands, who controls this planet Shura. And they're frustrated because they cannot find such a thing. So that was my opening scattered.
Yes, well, that's right. And you're right that the depiction of the character interactions in A Door to Ocean are strongly influenced and modeled after the Philadelphia Quakers, who I was very involved with for several years. And so I think that the dynamic of unprogrammed Quaker worship and Quaker communities was central to my thinking. But when it came to the community under stress and faced with repelling invasion, that was also very much influenced by Jean Sharp, mm-hmm. who was had no religious involvement, but Jean Sharp's view of nonviolent revolution and nonviolent resistance. The importance of Jean Sharp is that his view was that nonviolent resistance can work. It does not have to have a religious basis. And that was very important to me. As a scientist, I wanted to depict a way that nonviolent resistance actually could work without depending on mysticism. And so I would say that every plot element in A Door to Ocean has a basis in something from the history compiled by Jean Sharp. So Jean Sharp wrote a history of all the nonviolent actions that he could find. And so every plot element I used had a basis in historical fact.
Okay, so. Yes. I mean, I think that's abundantly clear. I mean, I certainly noticed plenty of them, if not actual historical events that had happened, clear resonances. I guess I just want to clarify briefly. I said Christian anarchism, and I think it often is, I might would call it transcendental anarchism. It's often called Christian anarchism. For me, I often use this term to try and distinguish from the violent tradition of anarchism. But I should also stress, I was raised in a fairly fundamentalist, religious tradition. I am in no, respect. I mean, I'm an avowed and open atheist, and yet, for whatever reason, I find myself drawn to this, you might say the Christian wing of anarchism. And I also briefly, I interviewed an expert on Gandhi, and it was a somewhat controversial interview with my listeners. And Gandhi remains a controversial figure in the history of anarchism. But this expert on Gandhi insisted that Gandhi was also not a religious believer in the sense of believing that there is a different mystical, unscientific world, that Gandhi used religious terms to express ideas that were not religious. And so we're just constantly, yes. Yeah, go ahead.
So I agree with that to a point. I studied Gandhi to a large extent. And what I found attractive about Gandhi was that for him, it wasn't that he used, just that he used religious terms. Gandhi fully believed in his religion, but he found that for him, religion was entirely consistent with material fact. Mm. So what he argued was that that material fact, materially speaking, that nonviolence could win as a material strategy, and simultaneously that his religion supported that. So for him, it was very important that the material was consistent with the mystical. I think that would be fair to say. And there are points in his writing where you see the tension. There are rare points where he says, well, I'm not sure about this. But the fact that he has those rare points shows that as a main assumption, that was very important to him. That, and so Gandhi had many practical considerations for example, he would organize demonstrations with the assumption that the coordinating leaders of those demonstrations would be arrested. So he would have a succession level of 30 levels deep. Okay, so that was clearly a material strategy. There was nothing in the mysticism about it, okay? But at the same time, your mystical belief would support that yes, there should be, it should be possible for anyone in a community to become a leader. So I think that would be true of Gandhi. And you see those kind of dynamics in A Door into Ocean also.
This conversation, well, I'm already drawn into a path that I don't want to go down too far, because I'm currently reading a book called Transcendence for Beginners by a biographer and philosopher named I get the title right, Transcendence for Beginners by Claire Carlisle. And she sort of starts with Spinoza, who precisely is this philosopher who I have always sort of bounced off of, who offers up a mystical view of the world in which mysticism and materialism are united. And the philosophers have been arguing since Spinoza, so for centuries, about whether Spinoza is a mystical thinker or not. And for Spinoza, his wedding of the mysticism and the materialism is so tight, is so complete, that I think it's impossible to put him in one bucket or another. Yes, go ahead.
I'm familiar with that argument of Spinoza. I would have to say, though, about my book, that you don't have to know any complicated philosophy to read the book. That in my book, people from very simple backgrounds, you know, a simple villager, a simple ocean dweller, fisher folk, you know, those kind of people are capable of the kind of things that go on in my story. Okay, so for instance, one of the things that the ocean people do, they're called sharers, and so they have developed a physiological mechanism where when they are under stress, they turn white. Their breath microbes release all their color and they turn white, and then they're in a trance and they just sit there and they can withstand any pain or anything that is done. So anyone in their community is capable of this white trance. And it means that when the invaders come and try to make them do things, you know, they just enter white trance. And it's something that anyone, it doesn't have to be a special one in the village, can do. And so they all have these abilities. Partly they're one of the most interesting things in my book is the language. So the sharer language is one in which subject and object are interchangeable. So in any given sentence, you can know what the subject and object are, but they're not expressed differently. So you say, I hit something, it's like saying that thing hit me. So this means that you can never say, if you say I will destroy something, then that implies that thing will destroy me. There's a reciprocity in the language structure. Okay, so that means they are always aware of the shared consequences of any act, and no one can tell them to do anything. You know, the soldiers say, well, we order you to do this, but the sharers can't hear that, because if they're ordered to do something, then that's like they're doing it to the other. And that language, I don't see that having been done in any other novel. It's a very unique approach to language. And that language approach is a very important part of my book.
Yes. And I got, you know, I mean, I got so excited, I almost jumped out of my chair when very early in the novel, when the characters from the patriarchal world and the ocean world are explaining the world to one another, and someone says, the young man or boy from the land planet says, you know, the protector rules all of this planet, and the sharer responds, well, that means everyone also rules him. And this is one of my, you know, one of my deepest convictions from the study of political history, is that every political system is in some ways a democracy. It doesn't matter, you know, what the king says, if the soldiers don't follow the king, and if the people rise up against the soldiers, it doesn't matter what the soldiers want. If you rule, that also means reciprocally that you are ruled. And I thought that was one of the clearest statements of this, what I would describe as this underlying democracy or anarchy under every political system. And then the way you use this language drew it right out in a way that was just so clear. And that's going to be one of my slogans. Someone who rules everyone is also ruled by everyone. It was just delightful.
Yes, I would agree with that. That point is a central point of my novel, in fact, of all my novels, because since then I've developed this theme of resistance and responsibility for rulership in the series of all the novels of my Elysium cycle do that. And in a way, for me, that's a message for readers. You know, you can't just say, well, the government's awful and there's nothing to do about it. That's letting out your own responsibility. Okay, because in fact, all governments depend on the agreement of people to obey. And Gene Sharp actually studied this semi-scientifically, and he estimated that in order to govern an uncooperative population, that history showed that you needed an occupation force of about 10% of the population of the country, okay, which is something to think about when our country attacks other countries. You know, what kind of occupation force are you prepared to put in, right? It didn't work well. And people always say, well, but Americans are too soft. Well, you know, Russia didn't find it that easy to control Ukraine. You know, it's the same problem for Ukraine. Even the Russian army is not enough to go in and occupy Ukraine, despite being the most violent army out there. Okay, so I think when you look at examples like that, that gives you an idea of, you know, how even a nonviolent non-cooperation could work.
Yeah, no, I am completely convinced. So another, to stick with Gandhi for a second, one of the famous critiques of Gandhi was that he thought that Nazi Germany could have been defeated by nonviolent means. And you're supposed to think that this is laughable and naive, but it seems to me it's obviously true if enough people it didn't happen, but the idea that nonviolence couldn't have worked in that case, it seems that nonviolence was very unlikely to work in the Germany that existed in 1941, but a large enough nonviolent movement in 1933 or 32 could have worked. I can't see any argument that a committed and large enough nonviolent movement would ever fail. I guess the devil is in the commitment and large enough. And that is one thing. Go ahead.
Yes, I agree with that. And in the case of Gandhi, Gandhi's words have been cherry-picked. You know, Gandhi resisted making any kind of comments about Nazi Germany, and in fact withdrew the resistance to the British during the World War II, saying that, well, Britain had their own issues now. It's not ethical to push them. Okay. However, from a distance, you know, people demanded and kept getting him to write these letters. And he wrote things that, said, well, resist. You know, he said that the Jews should resist, but he hadn't, you know, he had no idea what was going on. He did point to ways that nonviolence could work, but that was under questioning. In fact, history shows that some nonviolent resistance did work and that more resistance could have worked. There were cases where a particular group of German citizens rose up against the Gestapo in the prisons and demanded release of Jewish prisoners, and the prisoners were released. Okay, so there were cases of nonviolent resistance, and also some of the Nazi commanders wrote letters saying, well, the one thing that could destroy us is the resistance of the people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you're going to quote Gandhi, you should also quote Goebbels saying, well, you know, this is the one thing we're afraid of. So I think that in general, peace resistance is the way people discount it is by cherry picking particular points and ignoring successes. And, that's a common thing.
Yeah, well, the entire history of anarchism has been that sort of, you know, the claim is essentially that anarchism has never worked. And that's if you define anarchism in a few very specific ways and then point to the time that those anarchists were murdered by the state. Under that definition of anarchism, then anarchism has never worked. But I find that a pretty shallow definition of anarchism. I don't know what you think. I have detected, I think in the Trump era, or just over the past decade or so, and increasing emphasis on, you know, how am I trying to put this? It seems to me that figures who once would have been receptive to nonviolence and had signs that said love Trump's hate are now saying something like we have to kill all the Nazis or things like that. I mean, I think I've seen a lot of people get pushed far enough that they think now it's time to abandon nonviolence. And that's something
that always happens when there is a repressive regime.
Yeah.
And I think that some people find it particularly discouraging to see that we have to fight the same incompetent leader over again. And at the same time, if you look at the major sources of resistance, they are overwhelmingly nonviolent. The Indivisible Movement is well organized and nonviolent, and so is the anti-ICE movement. If you look at the anti-ICE protests, there's very, very much attention to nonviolence, to maintaining a positive approach through humor and imagination and positive means. And the ICE protesters in Minnesota used nonviolent means, from the whistles to the hidden rooms and support and so on. So I think actually that the current resistance is doing remarkably well considering what we're up against. And in my own community, since 2016, we have maintained a resistance in this red county called Signs on the Square, where every Saturday we hold signs of resistance on the square. And we've done that throughout as I said, every Saturday since 2016. We didn't stop during Biden because we knew it wasn't over. So we focus very much on positive expressions and also on getting back the votes. I mean, the big problem in our country is that people need to vote. We have a mechanism. We are not a dictatorship. We actually have a democratic mechanism, but we just need to use it. You know, the voting rates, especially in midterms, are appallingly low. And what people need to do is to get out and vote.
Yeah, I mean, I've had friends tell me, you know, oh, well, you know, the legal system needs to take care of this. Trump needed to have been impeached and all that stuff. And I mean, I have no Trump needed to have been removed from office. I have no problem with that, certainly. But if you in this current system in which we are in, voting, I mean, voting will work until it doesn't. And right now it is still working. I have a lot of friends who are afraid that the midterms won't take place or they will be falsified. I see no evidence that's going to happen. But if that does happen, then the solution is simply more resistance. I mean, that just, maybe this sounds tedious, but that's the answer.
Well, some of us look to Weimar and where there was a democracy and look to how that democracy collapsed and what could have been done and what was done. And one of the problems for the Germans during Weimar was they lacked a long-standing tradition. Fortunately, we are more fortunate. We possess a 200-year tradition, very imperfect tradition, but still a formidable tradition. And it has been heartening to see how many judges have ruled positively for democracy and very forcefully saying things that judges don't usually say from the bench. And so I think that our chances are good in that we still have this tradition of democracy. We have a much deeper tradition. And if we speak up and use our vote, I do think that we will prevail. But it takes a lot of work. One of the problems today is that people are reluctant to go out and speak with their neighbors. So in my book, A Door into Ocean, there's a lot of neighbor speak. Everyone is speaking to the one that lives on their same raft or back on the land planet. It's all in one village. There's a scene where the boy, Spinel, takes what he learned from the ocean planet and takes it back to his village and says, well, you know, in this village, we can do what the Scherer people did. We can do it with our own traditions. And they take their own spiritual traditions and they sit down in the square and refuse to be moved. And so I think that if we take the traditions we have, we can do it, but it takes a lot of work. And today Americans are so used to using our phones that we forget that you can actually talk to someone next door. People often don't even know their neighbors anymore. And we try to do what's called canvassing, which is you go out and knock on doors of strangers and talk to them about what concerns them. And it's so hard, people find it hard to do that because it's a tradition that we're losing. So that's what we need to do. We need to get up and talk with our neighbors and get people out to vote, and we will prevail.
Yeah, I completely agree that we have started to experience the world as something that is mediated by our phones. And, you know, mass media's with radio or even newspapers is 100 or a couple of 100 years old. But and it seems to me that, you know, fascism as it was practiced in Italy and Germany partook greatly in people switching their focus away from their day-to-day life to the mass media, especially of the television. But what we're experiencing now is a level of distraction, and I would say maybe abstraction from the day-to-day that is certainly unprecedented. And, you know, I have elementary school kids. They want to know when they're getting a smartphone. And, you know, I have a smartphone. I got rid of my smartphone, but I was, for various work reasons related to my job as a professor, there's certain apps that I just was required to have by my university.
We shouldn't blame the smartphones too much. It's too easy to blame technology. You know, Gandhi was an expert at the use of the technology that they had at the time. He made sure that there were journalists that depicted and broadcast all the demonstrations that were run. So that was the technology then. The technology today can be used so the revolutions in the Middle Eastern, the Arab Spring, were run largely by cell phones. So cell phones can also run revolutions. I think that use of that technology is actually very important. One good thing that the cell phone does is it means that we can see what's happening in other countries. We can see in real time. Remember, during the Vietnam War, it might be a month behind that you would find out about the atrocities that occurred. But today, it's in real time. People are getting seeing on their cell phones what's happening in other countries, and it can't be hidden. So I think technology has its use. It's just concerning that when you're letting technology replace the human interactions, then it gets to be a problem. It was also a problem. Remember, we just came through a pandemic, mm-hmm. and the pandemic had a lasting impact, and that, we can't ignore that, but we do have to get beyond it. But one of the impacts of the pandemic was suddenly we were all living on Zoom, those of us that were wealthy enough to do that. So we need to recognize that, but be getting beyond it and recover this idea of meeting neighbor to neighbor while still making use of the technology we have.
Yeah, I mean, I've grown increasingly skeptical of the smartphone as a technology, but as it exists now, it is run by, they are controlled by oligarchs with the goal of preventing us from engaging in the world in front of us and making our own choices. And when it's put that way, when I'm demonizing the smartphone, it is, I can imagine a use of handheld computers that is not monetized and dominated in this way. I can't really imagine it in the current economic system of 2026, AI and smartphones, whatever value they might have. It's hard for me to see them as having any good value when they are controlled by Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, and whoever else you'd like to add.
In my novel, A Door into Ocean, the technology that the sharers had was biological and distributed. So, for instance, they sent messages using insects called click flies that were genetically programmed to carry messages. And of course, the insects reproduced and sent the messages everywhere. So there was no central control of this insect DNA messaging. And then data storage was also greatly distributed. So the entire library of everything that the sharers knew was stored in the DNA of trees, okay, the raft trees. So everyone had access. So that was kind of like everyone has access to the cloud and the internet, but it was biological and it was not under control of particular oligarchs. I do think that we underestimate the potential of the internet, that it's still available for distributed knowledge. It is true that certain things like IP addresses and the fundamental rules of the internet are still run by a distributed committee, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's a form of anarchy.
Yes.
So we tend to forget about this one form of anarchy that's still out there, despite what the oligarchs are doing. There have been various threats to make different levels of the internet and so on, but that's never happened. Ironically, the reason it's never happened is because you would lose contact with your consumer base. Okay, so there is a certain power in that, and there is a power in distributed capitalism to that extent. But it's up to us to make use of these things before we lose them.
Yeah, I agree. I agree completely. I mean, the internet, Cory Doctorow just had a piece about RSS, which is a form of syndication, which is how, in fact, podcasts are shared and anyone can use it. The underlying infrastructure of the internet remains democratic and anarchic. Tim Berners-Lee, when he described how he wanted the web to work, he said he wanted it to be non-hierarchical in its organization of information. A absolutely hierarchical and capitalist system has been erected on top of this underlying platform. I mean, I don't use Substack. I publish, I don't write my newsletter very often, and it has a quite small readership, but I publish it on Ghost, which is a platform that can be RSS syndicated. It has all sorts of things, but it's also always mine and can connect to anything else. Substack so far has treated its writers pretty well and seems to have not in any way abused its power. But if you are on Substack, the people who run Substack, in the same way that if you are on Facebook, the people who run Facebook have a certain level of control over you. We are trading out the anarchic neighbor of the internet for the efficiency of centralization. And it's something that we've regretted, I think, over and over again.
Well, I think we have multiple platforms, and the thing is to make use of what we have now and try to do better with, you know, you're talking about Substack and Mastodon and Blue Sky. There are opportunities to do better, and so I think that's good. I would also say that for people interested in these issues, including the biological versions, that some of my later novels address these, in particular Brain Plague. So Brain Plague, although it was published in 2000, but it predicted everything we have now where in terms of the internet, except the internet is inside your head and plastered on your retina. So that's what the world of Brain Plague is like. And the internet is plastered on your retina. And not only that, your body's bacteria are intelligent and are posting things on your retina alongside what's posted by everybody else outside. So if you want to see a view of what the world looks like with the internet plastered on your retina, including all your body's microbes, Brain Plague is about that. And it raises very interesting questions about to what extent are we controlled by the outside and by our microbes. And more recently, Minds in Transit is a sequel to Brain Plague that adds in AI characters as well. So I would recommend Brain Plague and Minds in Transit to people interested in those ideas.
So I mean, I appreciate that recommendation for the listeners. I'll take it for myself as well. You got to maybe I'll be in touch, but you got to give me a little time to read these books and probably also finish up the semester, you know. There's still a semester looming for me. I mean, I should say, apropos of nothing, but just because I'm sitting in my office right now, my office mate, let me see if I can turn and still keep my face near the microphone. His books on his desk right now are called Blue Mind, Why We Swim, Undrowned, and Hydrofeminist Thinking with Oceans. So I'm in the right spot to be interviewing you. I'm afraid I have not been working on ocean thinking, but this is a fascinating topic. I just realized, especially as we're, you know, moving towards the end of our time, one thing that I wanted to make sure I talked to you about, because I've only had in this podcast one, whatever you want to say, centrist or mainstream figure who's been willing to come on. Otherwise they all avoid me, you know. And it was this economist named Brad DeLong, who worked in the Clinton administration. He's a very smart and interesting guy, and we had, I think, a good conversation. But when I asked him about News from Nowhere and The Dispossessed, and next time I'll say News from Nowhere, The Dispossessed, and A Door into Ocean, he said, you know, yeah, these societies work as anarchist societies. It can work, but they're poor. They're not very good societies. They don't have everything they want. And that's just, we want to live in a better world than that. I saw this again in A Door into Ocean. So the invaders keep saying, like, well, you have all these wonderful technologies. why don't you just make the, why don't you, you know, terraform the world more to make it perfect for you and none of you can die and you can have enough food. And their response is that that's not how the world is supposed to be. So I wanted to see what you think about this complaint that if you can have a wonderful anarchist society, but by doing so, you'll have to be in balance with nature. And if you're in balance with nature, you can't have skyscrapers and fast food joints and Walmart, which those all seem mostly bad to me. But that's the, you know, that's what Brad DeLong said when he was on my podcast, representing the mainstream economists, is we can't have anarchy because then we can't build so many things. I wanted to see what you had thought about that as you were writing the book.
Well, that's an interesting question, that you can't build so many things. So I think the question of technology and, say, by extension, urban life, usually when people think of technology, they imagine an urban world like the cyberpunk kind of world. And so there, I think that it gets complicated. First of all, you have to define what kinds of technology. So in my book, A Door into Ocean, the one kind of technology that the sharers had that was high technology was biology, mm-hmm. biology and medicine. I think when it comes to biology and medicine, everyone wants to have a healthy body and mind. And so a high level of medical technology is something that you always want to have. And because the sharers are genetic engineers, they have a high level of medical technology. At the same time, though, if your medical technology is too advanced, then you get into the problem of you end up being just plugged into a machine all the time. And so that's a question. To what extent do we all want to be plugged into machines? Mm-hmm. You know, people that live to a great age end up spending their last years living in hospitals with machines. So that's an open question, and it's one that does not have an easy answer. Now, other kinds of technology, the hard thing to realize is that I think the person asking those questions, well, how do you live without these high levels of technology? First of all, who has those levels of technology in society today?
Yes.
So I live in a part of the country where yes, everybody has a cell phone, but suppose you had a genetically engineered insect instead of a cell phone. Okay, you could have mass communications. So, if you look at people who owns the skyscrapers, who owns the factories. Factories where people either get jobs and are paid, you know, minimum wage. Who really owns all that stuff versus who's out of a job and hooked on meth and whatever? It turns out that a relatively small the proportion of our society that is middle class and has a good middle class life is declining, right? That it's paradoxical. While we gain more and more technological powers, the proportion of us that actually have access to those is declining. The proportion that has health insurance is declining. So the sharers have a world where everyone gets health care, you know, like Denmark and Greenland, right? You know, that the embarrassment when our president said, well, I'll bring a hospital ship to Greenland, but they already have all the health care they need in Denmark. So if the sharers are more like Denmark and Greenland, okay, then you think, and they also have technology in their societies, but somehow it's not this overdone technology where we're building so many data centers to destroy the planet. So I don't think technology is either or. I think that if power becomes more distributed, then the world is a little flatter. So then more people get more of the technology there is. And that actually, that's a healthier more happier world than a world where there are a few extremely wealthy people that mess things up for the rest of us.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, first of all, people always mention, when you start mentioning reducing the amount of technology in society, people always mention medical care. That's the first thing they go to. And it's very easy to say, if we had a much less technologically advanced society, if we didn't have the ability of certain drugs, we wouldn't be able to treat type 1 diabetes, but we would have a lot fewer cases of type 2 diabetes. I mean, I think that's an easy answer. The next thing, and this is something that David Graeber was highly associated with, who was, you know, the inspiration of my podcast, is to say, but we want both of these things. We would like highly advanced medical care and trains and, you know, electric vehicles without choking the skies with pollution and oligarchs. And if it's a choice between a hunter-gatherer society and what we have right now, well, sign me up for the hunter-gatherer society. That's easy. That's an easy, obvious choice.
Well, I think that's a false choice. But we all know that's a false choice. That there's a range of things. Now, one thing, in Adorned Ocean, the share community was very small. There were 800,000 people distributed around their ocean planet. So for societies that are larger, I think the degree of anarchism that you're talking about may not be possible. And that's really not the point. It's easy to imagine having fewer oligarchs and more, to think of it as a spectrum and think, well, the more you distribute and flatten down the spectrum, the better off everyone is and the better off science and technology are. Okay, so because there are countries in Europe and in Central America that manage, you know, the healthcare and a certain technology level. So we already have models, and part of it is taxation and regulation. We need to be a society that understands that we need to contribute to the common good and have more taxation and regulation, in fact, that distributes the wealth. So I think you have to think of it as more a spectrum than say, well, it's either or, you know, either our society or hunter-gatherer. That's nonsense. That's a false choice.
I agree. I agree completely. I mean, I still want to say I'll take hunter-gatherer over our society, but I think that false choice is not coming from the anarchists. The false choice is coming from the oligarchs. You have to give us everything we want in all of our data centers, or otherwise you'll just be scrabbling for roots in the mud. So I have this two-part response to this, which is, first, I'll take scrabbling for roots in the mud. Thank you very much. I bet I could make a pretty nice stew. And secondly, no, that's not the choice between Elon Musk gets whatever he wants, or we don't get to have trains and doctors. We can have trains and doctors and no oligarchs. It wouldn't even be that hard. As you said, we've done it before and societies are doing it right now. And this ideology that it's a choice, you can have, hierarchical wealth or shared poverty, I think that is the ultimate false dichotomy, and I agree, we need to reject that choice. Have we reached a stopping point? Yes, Joan, is this a good place?
I think that's great, and I've certainly enjoyed talking with you about all these interesting ideas and to see what your other authors are writing about. And I look forward to hearing from any of your readers and anyone who reads my books. I do answer fan mail, and I'm always, I always enjoy continuing these conversations.
Okay, wonderful. I mean, I found you through your website, so I'll put a link to that website. And before we go, anything else you would like to say?
I think we pretty much wrapped it up. Thank you.
We did it. All right. Thank you, Joan.